best-laid plans of mice and men often go awry. I'm fairly sure most travellers would be familiar with that saying, or they would at least understand its sentiment. It's a mantra for the travelling life, something you can mutter to yourself as your meticulously researched and painstakingly planned holiday comes crashing down around you in total disaster. Hi, I'm Ben Groundwater, and you're listening to Flight of Fancy, the traveller.com.au podcast. Today we're talking about misadventure, about the times when it seems like your best laid plans are determined to go awry. Because after all, disaster stories are the best stories. This is what travel is all about. Today we're going to talk about how these disasters happen, and we're going to talk about how to get out of them. And two people who have some of the best disaster stories you've ever heard are right here with me. The first is a travel writer, an explorer, an adventurer, and someone who once made it to the front page of the national newspapers for all the wrong reasons, Flip Burns.
All the wrong reasons.
Nice to have you, Flip.
Thank you. When you said misadventure, I thought you were personally referring to myself.
Yeah, well, we will dig down into that as we go along. And also joining us today, we have a traveller.com.au writer with 40 years' experience. He's a novelist, a food reviewer, a football fan, and his first ever overseas trip was to an active war zone, Keith Austin.
Hey, good morning.
Keith, thanks a lot for coming along.
No worries.
Now, Flipster.
Yes.
Let's start with you. I mean, travel experiences that are most memorable for you, are they the disasters or the successes?
Oh, that's a really hard call. But I have to say that any trip that doesn't have, I guess, an element of either, and if everything goes according to plan, it's just a little bit benign. Travel for me is really about the unexpected moments, and they're the ones that stand out in my mind, particularly the disasters, because often they lead to success in strange way.
Okay.
You know, something completely unexpected has occurred and you've ended up in a different, sometimes city, hotel with a different person than you're expecting. And, yeah, it can take on a whole new shape. And sometimes, would you agree, Keith? Sometimes disasters can lead unexpectedly to, some really great events.
Oh, look, I think the thing with disasters is that they, well, if you survive them, they make the best stories afterwards.
Yes.
You know, it's like, how was your holiday? I was okay. Everything went according to plan, blah, blah, blah. But if you say, oh, my God, I turned a corner and it all went tits up from there on in, that, you know, they make great yarns. That's the thing.
Yeah, that's why
I think they're more memorable.
Yeah, that's true. And then, you know, there's something about the perspective of distance being that you forget, you know, what it felt like to be in a foreign city with no money and hungry at midnight.
You tend to forget all the really, truly bad parts about it.
Yes.
You just focus on the hilarity.
And it just became a really good story.
There's a quote in a book called The Journey, and I'll paraphrase this, but it's that adventure is just discomfort recalled from the comfort of an armchair.
Right. I think that's about right.
Yes.
So, yeah, I think that's, you know, at the time, and I've been in some places where I've gone, oh, my God, what am I doing? But afterwards, when you're in the pub and you're telling a story and you're
it's
having
hilarious.
A bit of fun, it's hilarious.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, all the fear's taken out of it. Yeah. You know, all that gut churning, oh, my God, I'm going to die.
Yes.
You know. I used to have a group of friends, well, I still have this group of friends, but we used to go on what we called the boat trip every Australia Day weekend. We'd hire a houseboat around the Gold Coast Broadwater and we would sort of, you know, just spend 3 days cruising around on the houseboat. And for the first 3 or 4 years, it would pretty much always, there would be some sort of disaster because none of us had any idea what we were doing on a houseboat.
Yeah.
The first ever trip, the first ever day, we managed to break all three of the golden rules that they gave to us, which was don't drive the boat at night, don't go into a marina, and don't drive drunk. Because we'd organised to pick up a friend in the marina at about 8 o'clock at night and we'd been on board for 3 or 4 hours. So, you know. And we loved it. And the thing was, though, as time went by, we sort of got to know what we were doing a little bit more and we didn't run aground on sandbanks and we didn't do stupid things. And it just became a little bit kind of boring because everything was fine. We didn't come away with it with all these amazing stories. It was just like, we went on a houseboat. And,
I've just done a trip just like that. I was on a canal boat in North Wales with two of my best mates. And we were on there for 3 days. And by the third day, I mean, these canal boats are long. They're like, you know, 60 feet long. And you're at the back with a tiller thing that is anti-intuitive. You press left to go right to go left. And the first day where we were doing what the boating fraternity out there calls the snake, which is...
What's the snake?
Are you overcorrecting?
I'm not in this fraternity.
You're going down these canals, you know, like this, you know, like a snake, bouncing off the side like a billiard ball. I thought I'd sunk this thing at one point. I thought, can you possibly sink a canal boat?
Yeah.
I think I'm just about to do it. That first day was panicky and great fun, but by the third day, you know, we were, you know, taking it through these narrow locks, and it was, I enjoyed the first day more.
Sure,
right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, had you run aground, you would have ended up waist deep in water anyway. So,
as they say,
if you go overboard,
don't swim, stand up.
Yeah. It's not like you have to sit off a May Day if you go down in a canal boat. You're pretty safe, in safe waters, so to speak.
Do you guys think it is a kind of an inevitability of travel that things will go wrong at some point?
Well, it depends how far you are willing to push your adventure. If you're happy just to go to Rome and have a city tour, not much is going to happen to you, I don't think. But once you start, especially getting into the world of physical adventure, you know, climbing mountains, doing long distance hikes, that type of thing, it's only normal that the exposure to risk is going to escalate as well. But in direct proportion to that escalates the, you know, satisfying nature that the trip can be as well. So, so I think that...
Right, okay. What do you think, Keith?
Excitingly, the possibility for misadventure is everywhere.
I agree completely. In fact, I had one episode where I was living on a kibbutz in Israel in 1982, I think, 83. And myself and a group of mates decided that we were going to go down south into the Negev. And there's a big crater there called the Maktesh Ramon. And you basically climb down one side and you walk across this crater for like 5 days. And we had backpacks and food and all the rest of it. And this was like one of the driest places on the planet. It hadn't rained there for years. And we walked for a whole day and it was fantastic. You know, all these walking along this dry riverbed, and it was brilliant. And it got dark and we decided to camp. And we camped in a sort of tributary of the main dry river.
Yeah.
And that night it rained for the first time in years. But it didn't just rain, it bucketed down. I mean, it really poured.
Did you get flash flooded?
We did.
You did.
We did.
Did you get washed away?
The fire got washed away.
Yeah.
We had to retreat up this mountain side basically until we got to the point where we were in an overhang, and there's no way we could climb any further. And we were lying on this under this overhang, which was about 10 centimetres away from our heads, just lying there, hoping that this sudden raging river didn't get any higher, because it would have just washed us away. And so we stayed awake all night watching this
just creep higher and
creep higher and higher. And it was like inches from our sleeping bags, and then it all disappeared.
But you put that down as a disaster or a success?
I think it's a success that we survived.
There you go.
And in fact, the next day, the park ranger who had shown us into the park, we were just walking along. All our gear was gone. We were drenched. You know, the sun had come out again.
Sure.
He came and found us in a jeep and said, right. What do you want to do? Do you want to keep going?
Or, so what did you do?
We gave up.
Did you?
Because we didn't have any. All the food
you didn't have
was
anything.
Gone.
Sure, everything was gone. Yeah. Sure, you couldn't continue.
It was down a river somewhere.
Yeah.
That was a complete disaster.
Wash out, so you can say.
Complete wash out, yes.
It does seem like an appropriate place to be marching through the desert, though, yes. I think, with few provisions.
Yeah. So, we gave up and said, look, let's just go back to the Rangers station and get drunk, which is what I did.
But it sounds good as well.
You're listening to Flight of Fancy. If you're enjoying the podcast, you can find stories by our guests and other great writers at traveller.com.au.
And then it's that really fine line. We went to Petra. Have you guys been to Petra in Jordan?
Not. No.
Oh, I'm flabbergasted. Okay, guys, get to Petra.
All right.
Okay, that was one of those random decisions. I had 5 days and after working in Qatar and thought, okay, can I actually get to Petra and to Oman in 5 days? And it was, you know, logistics of flights and whatever. I did it. Never regretted that immense, you know, pain that I went to organise this stuff. So anyway, got into Petra. It's amazing. It is what you expect. There's all these carvings, found some unexpected bits to Petra I didn't know existed. But it's always about going that one step further. So we'd had this incredible day, but then I knew that there were certain spots in Petra where it's incredible to watch the night fall. You know, you have this beautiful sunset, and there was this place of, let's just say, the Mountain of a Thousand Steps. I don't know if that's what it's called, but it could have been
Sounds good. Yeah.
Off we went, the Mountain of a Thousand Steps, watched the sun go down, beautiful, romantic, just there with a mate, but it was still romantic. And then suddenly when the night had fallen, we realised that we're on the top of the mountain with a thousand steps and we can't see anything, including the steps of how to get down. No, nothing.
Right.
And then my friend, who's about 30, assured me that he was still a Boy Scout, which gave me more reason for concern. I'm like, 30 and a Boy Scout was.
Did you just keep failing?
Yeah, I was like, okay, stay fancy. Anyway, we made it down, and then later I read that people have, you know, fallen off that mountain because everyone goes up there to watch sunsets and forgets how to, you know, go down. This was a good 14 years ago. So I think we had this great idea of the torch on the phone, which was amazing, the Nokia, whatever it was. Coming down, it was empty. The whole place had emptied because it closes at nighttime. We were possibly the last people left in Petra. And then we come across Ahmed. And Ahmed had been the guy with the donkey during the day that we'd met. And when I looked into Ahmed's eyes, these deep, dark Arabic eyes, it looked to me as though I was seeing thousands and thousands of years of culture just in this one man. Like, he was fascinating. Probably, for me, the first Arabic person that I'd properly, you know, talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Why don't you come to my cave and sleep the night in Petra?" And because I had my friend with me, there's no way that I would have done that as a lone female traveller. Probably wouldn't have been up the Mountain of a Thousand Steps either. So we did.
I mean, that's one of those split decisions that we're talking about, isn't
this
it?
This is like exactly you know, the split decision.
Go with Ahmed to the cave.
Do we go to the cave? Yeah. And I'm like, to my friend, "Not sure about the cave." And he's like, "Let's go to the cave." And I'm like, "Okay, let's go to the cave." So we sat in the cave, and then I said, "Sorry, Ahmed, this little trick pony is out of here this evening." And, you know, back we went, a bit disappointed. But he gave me a scarf, you know, the red and white Bedouin scarf.
So you didn't
stay
at the cave then?
I didn't stay the night at the cave.
Okay.
Something about me said what
happened there?
So I've seen the cave. We've hung in the cave.
Yeah.
Cave's been done.
Yeah.
Didn't feel like
a good place to spend the night.
Nice cave. Nice cave, Ahmed.
Yeah,
lovely.
You did have like a pretty good cave. Yeah, good real estate for Petra. Yeah. It's kind of, you know, high up, a bit of a penthouse.
Do many people live there, or is it just, I mean...
I think there's a few people
who have... Is he essentially squatting there, or
We didn't go into the politics of it.
Right.
I think we weren't talking...
That cave's a five-star hotel now.
It is. No, but he gave me this scarf that to this day, it was his scarf, and he put his scarf on me. And I have not unfolded that scarf. However, was the last time that Ahmed folded that in 2000 and whatever is the way that has remained. And we went to the beach and a friend tried to shake out that scarf. And I was like, "Don't touch the scarf. That's got thousands and thousands of years of culture in that scarf. It's from Petra." And yeah, it's funny how you hang on to those things. But
yeah,
classic case of, you know, potential disaster that, yeah, it was probably one of my more memorable things. Way off the track, not on any travel media itinerary, but it was one of the most, the buzzword, authentic. Let's lay that one down. It was an authentic experience.
Yeah. I am really interested in those small decisions that you make.
Yes.
That take you on a completely different course and can totally change the whole face of your trip.
Yeah.
I was in Bangladesh once, and I had a friend who was living in Chittagong, and so I had to fly into Dhaka and then take the bus down to Chittagong to meet up with her. And I don't know if either of you guys have been to Bangladesh, but the roads there are probably the scariest, without doubt the scariest roads in the entire world. It's basically a small highway, two buses overtaking each other, going against two other buses overtaking each other at, you know, 120 kilometers an hour. At the last minute, they both sort of move in and you pass each other by centimeters, and then they start it all over again. And
well,
there's people
you,
by the side of the road.
Have you done a list of top 10? Most dangerous roads in the world?
I
is
have.
This at your top? Okay.
Yeah. I mean,
I've got a story idea
they
for you.
Film. They come through the bus before you leave with a camera and film you. And I was thinking, is this some sort of, you know, publicity
insurance
type thing they're doing?
So
and
they anyway, identify the bodies.
Exactly. So they can identify the bodies if you crash.
Awful.
And so I managed to get to Chittagong, and I was so incredibly freaked out by that experience. I was talking to my friend, and she said, "Well, you can take the night train to get back to Dhaka when you need to leave." And I thought, right, this is my decision. Take the night train, don't take the bus, because that is so clearly a better option and a safer option. And so I got the night train, and that was all going well for about 3 or 4 hours until the train crashed in the middle of the night.
What?
I think what happened was...
What?
two of the carriages separated and the brakes went on at the front and the back carriages caught up to the front carriages and sort of smacked into it. And so some glass panes of glass fell out and people got thrown around a little bit. And we all ended up having, I couldn't, you know, most people don't speak English, but some guy decided to help me out and everyone sort of piled off the train and started walking through the middle of nowhere at around midnight, and which apparently turned out to be this area that's known for smuggling because it's quite next to close to the Indian border, and it was really super dodgy. And anyway, we all sort of hiked through the bush for a little while until we found a small town, and there was a bus park there. And so we went into the bus park, and people started hammering on the bus doors, and the drivers all kind of woke up, opened up the doors, everybody jumped into the buses.
And that's really apocalyptic.
And then we drove all the way back to Dhaka. I was like, I can't believe I'm in these buses again. And we finally got to Dhaka.
On the highway?
Same highway. We got to Dhaka. I jumped in a tuk-tuk to get me to the airport.
Yeah.
And the tuk-tuk went for about 10 minutes or so and then just slowed down and chugged to a stop and basically just came to a halt. And the guy turned around and said, it's broken. So you need to get another one. I was like, please,
I am never leaving Bangladesh.
I was so pleased to finally get to the airport and get out of there. And I can just trace it back to that one small decision. But hey, who knows what would happen if I'd taken the bus.
Yes.
It could have been even worse.
Sliding doors. Total sliding doors. I had, I guess, one of my most life-changing trips was the Camino de Santiago. Okay. Have you guys done the Camino de Santiago?
No.
No.
Okay, you do.
I feel like we all do different styles of travel to you.
We do. Oh, yeah, we do. You guys probably do a lot more fun things. I know Keithy does a lot more eating things, which sounds great. But, yeah, this was just a random conversation, end of the ski season in Chamonix, and I said to someone, I'd like to do a bit of a hike. And they said, oh, there's this great hike down in Spain called the Camino de Santiago. And that's all I knew. And on the basis of that, I said, great, caught a train 1,000 kilometres down to a place called St. John Pierre Port. Mm-hmm. You have to register. So I went to the registry office and just said, look, you know, how far is this hike? Is it, you know, 5 days a week and which way is Santiago? And they just looked at me and said, it's 800 kilometres and it's that
and
way.
You're insane.
Yeah. And I was like, right. And then as I looked around, I saw that people had, you know, sparkling walking poles. And it turned out that people prepare for this thing all their lives. And I literally turned up and people on the trek ask for something. And it's quite for St. John, and it's quite normal dinner conversation for people to say, you know, why are you walking? And you can walk for religious experiences or whatever. And at the beginning, I found out you could do this by horse or by cycling. So my typical response was, you know, if I could have something, I'm asking for a horse at this point because I didn't realize it was so far. And this went on and on. I was walking with a couple of people. Eventually, about halfway through, about 500 k's in, it's very meditative, the walking. I started to really think, and I thought about all the things I'd done wrong in my life. You know, the time there was a girl at school who was bullied and I never stood up for her. You know, the times when you've been asked to step up to the plate and you hadn't. And then at midnight one night, I woke up my two walking friends and I said, I've got it. I know why I'm walking. And they're like, why are you walking? I said, for forgiveness. And they were like, wow, that's a good one. You know, that's really good. And then the news spread like wildfire throughout our little walking contingent. And they're coming up to me all day.
Down her thing.
Yeah, they're like, heard about the forgiveness. Like, you know, that's great. And yeah, I became the absolute biggest pilgrim of the Camino de Santiago. Starting out as the accidental pilgrim, I turned into a real, like, walker, and I loved it. And at the end, you have confession, which even as a Catholic, I'd never had. And he said, you know, like, what, you know, have you been forgiven for your sins? And I said, you know, really hope so, because I've just walked 800 kilometres for, you know, that kind of stuff. And he said, what have you done bad? Everything. And he goes, well, have you killed a man? And I said, no. And he goes, that's the only thing that you can't undo. Everything else, all good. So okay. I was sin free. Totally sin free, booked a ticket, went to Ibiza, hit the dance floors, start all over again.
Is it time to go back?
Yeah. It almost is, actually. I have to say, it's been a long time between dance floor and ticket. Yes, Keith, and you can come with me.
Yeah.
Keith, have you ever, I mean, are there any disasters that you could pin 100% on your own stupidity? Is there anything that you just think, yeah, that was totally my fault?
Yes. I was in Egypt. This was in the 80s, and I was working in Eilat in Israel.
Yeah.
In a youth hostel. Also diving for a guy who owned a pearl farm.
Right.
I used to dive down and get the pearls. Mm-hmm. Anyway, myself and a girlfriend decided to go down to Sharm el-Sheikh, and then you head back up towards Cairo along the west coast of the Sinai Peninsula there. Mm-hmm. And about halfway up, there's a road that heads east, and it goes to Mount Sinai,
right.
St. Catherine's mm-hmm. Monastery. You know, so Moses, Ten Commandments, I think, yeah, this would be great. So we get off the bus at this road, and we wait with a whole bunch of other backpackers, and we wait, and we wait, and we wait. And the bus that's supposed to come doesn't come. But what comes along is a flatbed truck driven by a couple of locals, and they say, jump on, all you people, and we'll take you to, you know, St. Catherine's. Fantastic. So we all pile on this thing, and we get sort of halfway to St. Catherine's, and they stop and demand money.
Right. That old chestnut.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, just stupid to think they weren't
How much money are we talking?
Yeah.
Well, this is the thing. I can't remember the exact amount, but I know it wasn't much.
Right.
Sure.
Okay. But
it was the principle of the thing.
Yeah.
And I was a backpacker. Every penny's a prisoner of war, right?
That's right.
So I'm there with my girlfriend, and she's going, pay him. And I'm going, no.
Keith, give him the 20 cents.
Exactly. Yeah, give him the 20 cents. I'm going, no, it's the principle of the thing. I'm not paying. All the other backpackers all paid up.
And how are they reacting to you refusing?
They're all going, come on, just pay them. I'm going, no, it's the principle of the thing. How dare they? You know, in my terribly English voice. Yeah. I don't, I'm...
The empire would not approve.
Yes. So anyway, they chucked us off.
Right.
And my girlfriend's going...
You're in so much trouble with your girlfriend
Oh, she wasn't a happy girl, it must be said. So they dump our bags off, they throw us off, and off they just disappear. We're in the middle of the Sinai Peninsula. It's really hot.
Oh, no.
And I don't know how far St. Catherine's is. I have no idea. So there's nothing we can do except put our backpacks on and walk in the direction that the truck went, which is now a dot in the distance. And we started walking in pretty much silence, I think, to begin with.
Sure.
And then hours and hours and hours and hours later, we finally, I mean, we walked for maybe 4 hours, and we finally came to this tiny village of St. Catherine's, but it's not the monastery.
Right.
Okay. So we get there, and we think, thank God for this. And there is nowhere to stay in this little tiny village in the middle of nowhere, because all the other backpackers have got all their rooms.
So you caught up to the other backpackers.
But they were all in their rooms by this, and it was starting to get dark. Dusk was, you know, coming on, and so one of the locals said, "Well, look, that sort of canyon down there, that takes us to St. Catherine's Monastery, which is at the base of Mount Sinai." We decide that, there's nothing we can do. And we're told it's a couple of hours to walk to get to the actual monastery. So we're walking down this canyon, which is like a single rutted track. And it's pitch black by this time. And suddenly from behind us comes this truck. And you can just see the lights coming along. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, we're dead. What have I done? And this truck comes up, blah, 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 and it pulls up. And it's all dark inside. And then these folding doors open and all the lights come on. And it is a truck full of UN soldiers from Fiji.
What?
Who are staying at the monastery.
Oh.
And so we got a lift from them. And once we got back to the monastery, there were beers as well. So I ended up drinking with these Fijian soldiers. Yeah. So it all turned out okay in the end. But up to that point, that not paying that 20 cents or a dollar or whatever
it was.
Sure,
because I was
on my high horse. How dare you try and extort me, sir?
This is the thing. Stupid, but that's something that you can't predict where you ended up. And one, you know, that's a reason why you travel for moments
that's
like
it,
that,
yeah.
When you end up.
It's worth stressing
roads,
that these disasters
usually,
well, I mean, for us, they've all worked out well, and we've come back with great stories to tell, which is really part of travel, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
This podcast is brought to you by Intrepid Travel. As the global leaders in small group travel, Intrepid knows a thing or two about making the right decisions. Their local leaders are not only travel experts, but teachers, gurus, and enthusiastic purveyors of unforgettable grassroots adventures. They'll take the guesswork out of the boring stuff, leaving you free to make up your own mind about the fun stuff.
like whether or not to eat that dried scorpion. Choose your next trip at intrepidtravel.com. What about, you know, we've talked about decisions, but what about the people that you meet as well? Have you, like, Flip, have you met someone who's kind of changed everything about a trip for you or about your entire life?
Well, I think we can only be talking about one trip and one person.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, so, look, I tried to go to Nepal 3 times, mm-hmm. or maybe 4, over the course of 10 years. Something always happened. There was the coup, the royal family got murdered, I got sick crossing from India. So 4th time, I guess it was, I finally got my visa and thought, well, let's just see if it happens, if Nepal wants me this time. I was on a trek to do the Annapurna, which is amazing. Have you guys done the Annapurna, Joe?
No.
Put on your bucket list. And this is going to be fun.
We've not been anywhere, actually. Have we? You've been everywhere, man.
No, except for on with, you know, peacekeeping Fijian soldiers. Hello. So, look, it was one of the worst trips that you could have in Nepal because the group had to walk single file amongst the most majestic mountains in the world, and it wasn't good. The bird watchers who wanted to have more space, and the tour leader said, you can have more space tomorrow, 5 metres each. And, yeah, this went on for 21 days. So I really felt that I hadn't heard the mountains talk, I guess, in a way. And that's why, you know, I like to have that kind of serenity. So I said, right, I've got 8 days before I have to be in Russia. Can I fit an Everest Base Camp trip in? And I can if I do it really quickly. I should be acclimatised. Mm-hmm. So I went back to Kathmandu.
It's the best way to get up to Everest Base Camp, isn't it? It's really quickly.
Well, I'll tell you what happened. Yeah, not really. I thought I'd go Alpine Light is what the stars call it. You just take small backpack and I grabbed a porter from the previous trek and off I went. And I'd put off going to Everest Base Camp because of the flight in. You know, it's a really hairy airport.
Yeah.
Listicle, top 10 airports of the world. It'd be a good story. So, yeah, so it was hairy going in, but I thought, okay, let's go for it. I wasn't supposed to be there. Technically, I was just killing 8 days.
Yeah.
And up I went. On the way, the day before Everest Base Camp, there's a valley that I call, small dip, called the Valley of the Lost Souls. And it's where people who haven't summited or come back from Everest, their families have left plaques. And they're really devastating messages of sorrow. It's like, you know, Tom, who never came home, you know, crushed our lives, but we carry on, you know.
And this is something really, you look at before you go up there?
It is, the day before you get there. And so there I was, and just before I got into the Valley of Lost Souls, my porter started chatting to his porter. I hadn't talked to anyone for 6 days by this time. I'd even said to my porter, it'd be best if we don't talk to each other, except for at the beginning of the day and at the end of the day. Okay. And it turned out he was the nicest chappy, and we had a great time together. I lifted my talking ban after about day 4 and decided that we could have some chats. So they started talking, and I talked to the guy who had the other porter and said, hey, our porters are friends. And he said, really? And I said, yes, it is. And that was Till.
And
that
Till
was
is.
It. I walked through Till is, wait, walked through the Valley of Lost Souls. This person came and said, come and have dinner with me at the tea house.
Yeah.
In we went. I started to feel a little bit prickly. Some could call it altitude sickness from trying to get up to Everest Base Camp in 6 days.
Yeah.
Oh, just a cold sweat down the back of my neck. And I thought, here we go. And it's a shame because the guy had a balaclava in the day and he was sitting side on to me at night. Couldn't quite see his face, but I thought he might be cute. So I walked out the back balcony, projectile vomited, had breath mints in my pocket, shook my hair out, popped a mint, went back in and thought, I've got 5 breath mints. Let's see how long this goes for. Sure enough, at the end of the night, I just said, look, I'm really sick. He came outside, held up my hair while I kept vomiting.
What a man. What a gentleman.
Good guy. And that was it. He went off to climb Everest and I saw him briefly and waved at him the next day. And then 3 months later, I get a message on Facebook going, hi, remember me? I'm like, not really. I was kind of indisposed at the time. We started talking and I was working on the London Olympics key thing.
Remember that,
a few months later. And he said, come over for dinner. Another spontaneous decision. Mm-hmm. Never thought that dinner was in Germany at this guy's house that I couldn't really remember. And just booked a ticket on EasyJet for €30 and went.
Wow. Cool.
Yeah, father of my children.
Wow.
Yeah, amazing. Father of my children. Yeah. No idea. Since then we had, 2 small babies and that was 5 years ago, just celebrating our 5th anniversary. And, a lot of random decisions involved in that, you know, yeah, who knew, basically, yeah, when I woke up that morning that I was going to meet the father of my children. Right. And even at the time...
That's what, I mean, it's so great about travel. Just, I mean, it just opens you up to so many of those random meetings, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Like, I just find, like, an everyday, you know, routine, you go to work, you come home, you have dinner, you maybe go out to a pub or something like that, but you don't have that many chances to randomly meet people. Whereas when you're travelling, there's just this huge sort of scope of options.
Mm. Oh, there is. You never know who you'll meet. And the funny thing about that was that, you know, I'd been really single for a lot of my 30s. Mm. And, you know, I'd do my hair and do my nails and go to the right bars in Sydney and all that type of thing. Never. Like, even rarely got asked out. And there I am in Nepal. I haven't, you know, showered for a week and I'm vomiting my guts up. And some guy thinks that's hot. So please explain to me, like, how the world
think
works.
It's hot?
Oh, no, we haven't had a reno.
You've not got a shower in your
house. Yeah. I'm like, so how about if this little underarm? Yeah, no. So I tell my single friends that story a lot because you just never know what's going to happen. And these random decisions, if only you could orchestrate them sometimes and go, I'm going to do something random today and meet the man of my dreams.
Yeah,
you know, it never happens only that way. You just got to have a lot of self-belief with decisions you make while you're travelling,
yeah,
I think.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, well, that's a pretty hard story to top, isn't it?
I can't top that.
You met someone, though, who encouraged you to go to Israel, which was your first ever trip overseas.
I'd been working on a local paper in East London, where I started when I was 20. And at the time, cadetships there were about 5 years long, and I was about 2.5 years into this thing, and I just met a nurse who was a friend of a friend who just had come back from Israel and had spent some time on a kibbutz and said, I had such a good time, you know, Israel's a really nice place, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, do you know what? I'm going to go.
Right.
So
was it an active war zone at that time?
Israel and Lebanon had been throwing mortars and rockets at each other up in the Golan Heights.
Right.
And it was about the time I think Israel decided enough was enough and they sort of invaded the Lebanon up there.
Right.
So, yeah, it was a war zone. But if you stayed away from the Golan Heights, you would find Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and Eilat, where I ended up, were, you know, perfectly fine. But that was, you know, for me, that one conversation. I mean, I can't even remember the girl's name. I just know she came back.
It changed the entire course of your life.
Absolutely. Because prior to that, you know, as a working class lad from East London, I'd been on holidays with my mates and things like that, but I hadn't actually strapped on a backpack and said, well, I'm going to do this. I'm going on my own. And the first time I went, I went for 6 weeks, and then I had to come back and earn some money.
Mm-hmm.
But then I went back again, and I think I stayed in Israel all told then for about 18 months and did various trips.
Did you finish your cadetship, or was that the start of travel writing for you?
No, that was I never actually finished the cadetship. No, but after I got back, I just applied to other newspapers and got jobs, basically.
But the travel continued? Was that
the travel, For my 20s, it was essentially come home, work on a newspaper for a couple of years, earn enough money so that I could take off and go travelling again.
Yep.
So, you know, I ended up hitchhiking around America and ended up in Hong Kong and China in 1985, I think, which was an experience. But it all came down to that.
From that decision.
One conversation.
Sure.
Yeah, right.
And me going, you know what? Life's got to be more than just this. So,
yeah. I owe pretty much my entire career to a random meeting like that as well. Yeah, I went out on a few dates with this girl in Brisbane back when I was working for a lifestyle magazine, just sort of cruising along, nothing really, you know, in mind for my career. And this girl told me that she was going on a 3-month trip to Africa in a couple of months' time. And she said, oh, you should come along as well.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, well, you know, that's fairly crazy. We've just had a couple of dates. And we ended up going our separate ways and just, you know, kind of remaining friends, but not really in contact. And this was before Facebook or anything, so we didn't really know what each one was doing. But I thought, you know what? Maybe I should just go to Africa for 3 months. And I booked myself on that trip and went along and turned up in this hotel in Nairobi. And this girl, Maya, is like, hey, Ben, how you doing? I was like, hey, Maya, this was a really good idea. And she's like, was it? Because
I'm starting to regret it. Was my idea a really good idea, Ben?
But I ended up doing this 3-month trip. Maya and I got on great. We're great friends. But on that trip, I met a guy called Costa, who it turned out was a driver for a company called Top Deck, which is a tour company in Europe. And he basically said to me, if you've got no plans after this, come and be a cook for Top Deck and travel around Europe with us for 6 months. And I thought, okay, sure, I got nothing else to do. So went up and worked for Top Deck for a while, met a girl who I really liked. She moved back to Sydney. So I thought, well, I'll move back to Sydney. That was a total disaster. Ended up getting a job at the Sydney Morning Herald.
Flight of Fancy Podcast 5, if you care to listen.
Yeah. You know, met people in travel and became a travel writer. And it all came down to that random couple of dates that I went on with Maya, who said, go to Africa.
Wow.
And I did, yeah.
Yeah.
You're listening to Flight of Fancy. If you're enjoying the podcast, you can find stories by our guests and other great writers at traveller.com.au. Now, we've talked a lot about disasters, but I think we should talk a bit about successes as well, because we've all had some fairly successful days. Particularly, I'm interested in the ones where you make all of the wrong decisions and it still turns out well. I had one in Africa. Actually, on that African trip, we were in Uganda, and the deal was we were going to go and see the gorillas. And you can either see the gorillas in Uganda. There's a forest that it goes between three countries, which is Uganda, Rwanda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Mm. And obviously, by far the worst one to go to is the DRC, because it's scary and lawless. Mm. But the guide that I had, his idea was it was also much cheaper if you go across into DRC. And it
is
was
that their country's slogan? Lawless and scary.
It is. Yeah.
I thought I'd seen that somewhere.
This is where, you know, the sort of fighting between the Hutus and Tutsis had spilled over into this forest. There were gorillas out there, but there are also actual gorillas.
Yeah, which gorilla? Like, G-U-E-R?
I mean, we were there to see one of them, but yeah, there was also the other.
Yeah.
But also my guide's plan was that rather than actually pay for visas, because that would be expensive, we would just go to the border in the DRC and give the border guard a bit of money as a bribe and leave our passports with him. And we would go on into the DRC and find some gorillas. And, you know, these gorillas, you can be searching for days to find them because they're just wild. You never really know where they are. And so we all jumped into the back of a ute in the DRC, drove through a few sort of
dodgy
villages.
Back of flatbed trucks, back of utes. Yeah. Theme,
and anyway, we got out, walked around we were walking in the jungle for about an hour before we found the gorillas. And it was about eight of them. And we had our hour with these gorillas. And it was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. Jumped back in the back of the ute, went to the border, collected our passports, off we went back into Uganda, found out the next day that a whole lot of fighting had broken out in that very town that we were in, and there were people, refugees, streaming across the border, and it all could have been horrendous, but it worked out to be one of the best experiences of my life.
That's a great call.
Beat that, yeah.
Not even trying.
Nope, not even trying.
I got nothing.
But you guys must have had some memorably successful days.
Okay, one of my days, South America, I'm thinking of. My first day in South America, it took me 3 hours to get my backpack stolen. Right. And I was moving to France.
And we're calling this a success, right?
I'll have to put it in context. I'm a half glass full kind of girl, I guess. I was moving to France afterwards, so it had everything in it. And a guy asked me for a cigarette light, stood up, sat down on nothing. That's how fast it was.
Wow.
And then went to get on the bus.
All of your belongings.
Everything. Yep. Except for I had a passport, four minties, and the clothes I was wearing.
Excellent.
That was it.
Yeah.
So, you know, at least
passport.
So you'd
be able to pick up a man with those minties, right?
Well, I had one with me. So, which is how I ended up wearing men's clothes for 2 months in South America. So I got on the bus, and, you know, most people in Lima are unemployed. And I remember getting on and just going, my bag's been stolen. And they all laughed at me. And I looked at them with my pointy finger and I said, you should all go get jobs, because this is why my bag
did you find
has been
that
stolen.
Endeared you to
whatever Ben I right. was over it at that point, so I got, but you know, I was being really cool about it, didn't want this to ruin the trip, but you know, on this 8-hour bus trip, things kept flashing up, like oh, you know, my glasses, and then my favorite this, and but I'm still cool. Stop for lunch, for recovery lunch, and then as I'm eating this soup in this, you know, roadside whatever, there's this red floaty thing, and I think, oh, bonus red floaty thing in my chicken soup. Keep eating, and it's not until the bottom that I see that there's a chicken head neatly cleaved in two, and I've been eating that, but still I'm so cool. I'm like, can't bother me.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Okay.
Let's keep going. Get to the town, writing to the insurance to say, look, everything's been stolen. Lights go out everywhere. So I stumble to the door and I see it's not just on the street, the whole city, the lights have gone out. And then suddenly my partner at the time, my boyfriend at the time, runs up the street going, flip, flip, our hotel is burning to the ground. And I just went, oh, what else can happen? So, you know, down I run. It turns out we were next to a disco and the Ecuadorian discoers were smoking and burnt their place down and then burnt the hotel down. And, you know, my first reaction was, oh, hey, is everyone all right? But it looked like everybody was out. And then secondly, my bag. And I was like, I've got no bag. So I just sat there drinking coffee on the side of the street. Yeah, just like watching the hotel burn down and just thought, okay, and again, what more could have gone wrong in that day? I've only, you know, I got off a girl from Linfield, you know, 18 hours earlier in Santiago or Lima. Yeah. And then, you know, 18 hours later, I'm in the middle of I'm not sure where. I own nothing. I'm wearing men's tracksuit pants and my hotel's burning down. And that, to me, was travel at its finest.
Oh, yeah.
I could not have
Definitely a glass half full.
I could not have scripted what was going to happen, you know, when I woke up that morning. And I was just on an absolute travel high. And I've been looking for that type of misadventure ever since. Not quite, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You're just liberated, so liberated in every way.
I went to, again, an off chance decision. I'd hitchhiked and driven across America. And about 1985, I suppose, and got to San Francisco and just went into a travel agent's there and said, we want to go somewhere. And the guy said, Hong Kong. I said, okay, why not?
I should travel together sometime. Yeah.
With no destination in mind.
With no destination, just meet at the airport.
We went to Hong Kong and we spent some time there. And then we just met some other backpackers who said, oh, you know, China's just sort of opening up and it's really cool. And so we went, all right, yeah, why not? We'll go to China. And in 1985, in China, very few people spoke
really
English.
Exciting. Yeah.
There were no, I mean,
we're not talking big skyscrapers.
No, absolutely.
The Shanghais and the Beijing.
The China that we know now, you know, Pudong area and all that sort of business. No. We basically got a cheap boat from Hong Kong. We didn't even go across the border. We got the boat up the Pearl River. I know we were third class or something. One of the smellier rides of my life, I have to say. And we just lobbed up. And at the time, nobody spoke English. None of the roads signs were in English.
Right.
All we had was a second-hand Lonely Planet guide, one of the first Lonely Planet guides to China.
China, sure.
And that's all we had.
Yeah.
So, and I would... we made our way up through Guangzhou and Xi'an, and we did the Yangtze River cruise and went to a place called Chongqing, which at the time was one of the great dumps of the planet, up through Xi'an, Terracotta Warriors and Beijing. And everything was a problem.
Right.
Everything was hassle. It was 6 weeks of absolute nightmare. Great to go to Xi'an and see the Terracotta Warriors and, you know, the places themselves are fantastic.
Yeah.
But getting between them, just buying a train ticket.
Really hard
travel. Yeah, right. Mm.
Buying a train ticket. You get up to the window and you try to explain to the guy that you want to go to this place and back again. And it took ages for you to realize that you couldn't actually buy a return ticket. You had to buy a one-way ticket. And then buy another one way to get at the other end.
Yeah.
Which they're trying to explain to you, but...
Which they're trying to explain to you, but, you know. And essentially we got to Beijing, and to give you an idea of how badly this was organised, we got to Beijing in, like, December. It's freezing in Beijing in December. And we cycled around Beijing for a week, wearing everything that was in our backpacks. The backpacks were in the, you know, the hotel empty. We were just wearing, we were like little Michelin men on these bicycles. And we got to the point where we just went, we need to get out of here. We need to get out of here. This is.
I like that it took at least a week for you to get to that decision.
Yeah. Well, I had to see the wall and I had to see, you know, Forbidden City.
Yeah.
And we basically got the train out, which in those days was 24 hours from Beijing back to Hong Kong. And we went into another travel agent and said, somewhere warm, please, which is how I ended up on a beach in Thailand for 6 weeks after that. But
is that when you said, now we're having fun? When you ended up on that beach?
Looking back, it was fun.
Yes.
At the time, it was warm. But the thing that it did is, despite the fact that it was all so hard, it was 6 weeks of really hard work.
Yeah, hard work travel.
1991, I went back and lived in China for a year. So it sparked a fascination for me with China. And I went back and I worked on a newspaper in Beijing, China Daily Newspaper.
So, guys, let's just pretend you've got... Well, I mean, it's not really pretending, is it? Let's say you've got yourself into a disastrous situation. Things are going wrong. How do you save it? How do you kind of pull it back from the brink?
Sure. It depends what kind of situation you are in. For example, if you are in the middle of an ice cap in Greenland and you need a helicopter that's going to be $22,000, you really want to have your travel insurance. So there are some situations in the mountains or in those wilderness areas where you want to have a personal emergency beacon or satellite phone.
Okay. How about you, Keith?
Mine would, I think, essentially be, I think absolutely, travel insurance is a big thing, especially, and, you know, emergency beacons if you're going to be in the wilderness, etc. But my big thing, I suppose, has always been just it's a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy thing. Don't panic.
Yeah.
Don't panic, because that's the worst thing you can do. You panic, you run around like a headless chook, and just calmly go, well, I'm in it. How do I get out of it?
Yeah.
That's it, really. If you really, really panic and you start running around, it will just get worse.
Yeah, and I think don't get too upset as well in a similar sort of vein, because you can tend to take these things a little bit too seriously. You know, your train doesn't turn up, or you're missing a connection, or something like that. It feels like a disaster, but it's actually really not. And the more sanguine you are about it, and the more you just sort of go with the flow, the more enjoyable the whole experience will be.
Yeah, and I think as long as you've got money for me is the last resort to everything. I don't know if either of you guys have ever had to sleep on a park bench in, say, Spain. But, you know, if you've got $50 in your pocket, that's a meal, it's somewhere to sleep, and it's a phone call home. You know, if you
keep some emergency cash in a bundle of socks or something in the
bottom of
your bag.
Yeah, or a second card if one desensitizes. Yeah. For example, if you happen to be by the Dead Sea. Speaking from experience here. If you really have not a cent on you and you're traveling alone, you are in so much trouble. So always having access to some type of cash is important, I think.
Good advice.
And if you're really ill, you know, when you get that deli belly type stuff, find a bush with big broad leaves.
Guys, what are the secrets to success, do you think, when you're traveling? Do you go on intuition? Do you think you have to plan things to make sure they turn out right?
Look, I think just for safety reasons, as I get older, I do tend to do some precautions, like, you know, I will land now and have a booked hotel, whereas before that was the unthinkable.
Right.
But I think it's really important to leave some element open to having those adventures, you know, unscripted days, unscripted plans. And if you can be really flexible, even flights that you can change. Like, to me, that's a real kind of thing.
Yeah,
I think,
as you get older, I mean, I went off on that first backpacking trip and woefully underprepared. The wrong backpack, the wrong shoes, right?
Yeah.
Probably the wrong underwear, I don't know. But it was a disaster waiting to happen.
Yeah.
Now, no, I won't do that anymore.
That's right.
But I think that, like you, I don't want to be crammed into an itinerary. I like to have that little bit of looseness about it, so that, you know, things can change. Or you can say, well, I like it here.
Yeah.
I'm going to stay another couple of days.
And I guess the risk factor of travel is kind of up to you, isn't it? You can choose to make these decisions that take you off on random paths which could end in success or disaster, or you can choose not to. You can choose to just hang around your hostel or your hotel if you want to, can't you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think another key element is cheap countries. I mean, in Oslo, if you miss a flight or whatever, it's going to be an expensive situation. If you are in Thailand or Cambodia, you can always get yourself out of trouble really easily with $100.
Yeah.
You know, suddenly it's
just there's also a lot more avenues to get yourself into trouble in places like that, I find.
Part of the joy of them.
Yeah. But you can get in and out pretty quickly. Whereas, you know, get yourself into an expensive country, Switzerland, Scandinavia, it's going to cost you a lot to get out of trouble. Whereas, you know, I find in especially those Asian countries, you can go from zero to hero pretty quickly.
Yeah, this is true. Well, guys, I want to say thank you very much for joining me today, Keith and Flip. It's
been
an absolute pleasure.
Benny, I thought we were just warming up.
We are.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's go to the pub. Yeah. All right.
If you would like to read more from Keith the Flip or myself or any of the other traveller.com.au writers, you can check us out on the website, traveller.com.au. Also subscribe to Flight of Fancy on iTunes or your favourite podcasting app. We'll see you next time on Flight of Fancy.